All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Now the second half of this weekend's edition, we are going to be shifting our focus a bit more for all those investors in the gold stocks as we are chatting with Tavi Costa, portfolio manager at Crescat Capital. Now, Tavi, I want to take more a big picture look to give everybody some insights on what Crescat is looking for in terms of investments, either red flags that would turn you away from them or the type of companies as well that you find that you really are specializing in more with a big picture outlook. Let's start with jurisdictions. A lot of people talk about tier one jurisdictions, but quite frankly, you can find companies in almost every country, it seems like. And sometimes countries get hot, sometimes they don't. Sometimes broad continents are largely avoided outside of just the simple tier one jurisdictions that everyone says, oh, you want to have a world-class deposit in a tier one jurisdiction. That's more or less obvious. What about filtering down to other jurisdictions? Which ones, Tavi, do you think have a good opportunity here? Which ones do you guys like that aren't just that mainstream tier one jurisdiction?
And I think it helps to have a macro framework to think about this question, and something that we've been obviously doing a lot at Crescat, which is when you have a view that we're entering a period of the next decade that is likely to be inflationary. By that, I mean just that inflation will run in average for the overall decade higher than prior decades, and you have cost of capital being higher as well. It's hard not to favor commodities over other things. And we know how most capital allocators have been really under allocating their own capital into tangible assets as a whole. And our view is very strong that we're seeing this deglobalization trends intensifying and looking for places in the world that will sort of benefit from this rather than the other way around. Like China, for instance, may not benefit from this. Is very important. And when you think about emerging markets are, in my opinion, in a very different stance. You have the net importers like China and India, and then you have geopolitical mess countries like Russia or China as well. And so Brazil is a place that actually falls into a different category of those. It's almost like any other most parts of the South American continent, which is very interesting because I think those economies will actually serve the world in a very different way and create different partnerships that we've had over the past years that are mostly served by places like China in the past and Russia as well. And so we think that when you look at the valuation of most of assets in South America, particularly Brazil, and we also have a strong view about Bolivia and other places that are becoming better, such as Chile, perhaps. And there are some negative sides of South America as well. But we're starting to become more and more bullish in that whole area just because of those macro reasons. And looking for opportunities there is fascinating because, yes, it requires everything has a price, right? I mean, the risk you're taking needs to be reflected in the price of the asset that you are buying. Therefore, that is certainly the case in some of the assets we've been buying in those areas. Those are also places that have been extremely unexplored. And some of those economies are looking to open up in order to attract more capital from institutions like ourselves. And so we're very glad to be in this position to be deploying capital in some of those areas. Brazil is and Bolivia are certainly my favorite, knowing that there is still risk for a lot of things. The political environment in Brazil has changed over the last year or so with the change in political leadership as well. However, when you think about the overwhelming, the underlying thesis behind this is kind of sort of being masked by those issues. And that is mostly because, in my opinion, the economy itself, which is very natural resource rich, is not only extremely correlated to the commodity market, But also, when you think about a commodity person or a fund looking to find exposure to commodities, is a very relatively small place. And so it's hard to spread your wing and diversify into different parts of the world. And so it's just hard to believe the South American economies won't serve as an alternative. And some places like Brazil might play even a bigger role than others. And some others like Bolivia have that carry a larger risk, but also have great opportunities when it comes to quality of assets as well. So, as I said earlier, everything needs to have its appropriate price as well, relative to the risk you're carrying in those areas. But I do believe that I think market is perceiving this as a much higher risk than what actually is. And considering the last 10 years as a factor, which I don't think will be the same. I think those markets are actually likely to outperform developed economies and do much better over the next decade or so.
Well, Tavi, I think this is a really interesting topic for investors to consider jurisdiction, because when you think about what Corey mentioned, the tier one jurisdictions, let's say Nevada or Idaho in the United States, or Quebec or British Columbia in Canada, a lot of people pile into those, but often those companies trade at a big premium to other companies as a result of people feeling like they're safer. But when you look at South American countries, the risk some people see is the political side and how that may affect taxation. So when you look at things like the direction Chile or Peru has gone, or Ecuador has kind of been a revolving door of good cycles and bad cycles, there's countries that were considered previously fantastic, like Peru or Chile, that have been under more pressure with investors. And then other countries like Argentina or Bolivia that you mentioned that were in the hurt locker, and they've actually improved, but they often trade at a dramatic discount, especially companies that have developed some resources or, have some exciting drilling that's proven there's proof in the pudding. Those companies usually trade at a big discount, similar to how West African countries traded a big discount to, let's say, North American companies. Is that where you see an arbitrage of value, where it's unrealized how valuable these projects are because they're trading at a discount? Or how do you discount tougher jurisdictions when you're taking an investment stake in them?
We're very conservative when it comes to that. I mean, as you guys know, we'd like to build models and to be as unbiased as we can in our decisions. And so we put into consideration what's the size of the asset that we're dealing with, grades that are likely to be delivered. Obviously, those are huge variables that can change over time and be improved as our accuracy and our more information comes along. But in terms of political risk, I think there's a long-term and a short-term cycle for things. The long-term cycle is very bullish for South America, meaning all the things I said that favor commodities and also favor a place that is very neutral, geopolitically speaking. I mean, very few economies even entered the World War II, in terms of being involved with those. Brazil is a great example. It's almost like the Switzerland of South America when it comes to doing businesses with China, doing businesses with Russia, and doing businesses with Europe and other places in Europe, and also in other places in like the US or Canada or Australia. It doesn't really care of who you are. It just wants to make money. And so that's sort of the long-term cycle that I think it's turning. It hasn't fully turned yet, but it's turning. And it will be turning as you see this sort of commodity market becoming stronger and stronger over time, and requiring more and more capital over time as well, will slowly transition into making South America a great opportunity. The short-term cycle is a little bit different, is when you have, a political leadership change, which happens in most places every 4 years. And once you have those, let's say in Brazil, the initial reaction can be a little bit negative. Now, majority of those presidents, especially if they have an agenda that is against exploring and developing and producing natural resources, which tends to be the case in most left-wing parties in those places. And remember, left-wing parties in South America are significantly more extreme than left-wing parties in the U.S. It's almost like the left-wing in the U.S. is supposedly a right-wing in South America. Sort of a joke, but true. And you can see this by looking at their agendas as well, that is quite similar to some of the Democratic parties here in the U.S. relative to what the right-wing agenda is in Brazil, for instance. But the point being, usually the first few years or so, you know, they tend to take a strong stance until they realize that's where the money comes from. It's from natural resources. And usually you see it ease up from those regulations and things tend to get better. I mean, there are cases where things go truly south, like you saw with Venezuela, but that was, again, on the back of a long-term cycle that was not very favorable. This was a time while commodities were not in a very good environment. I mean, we had oil prices collapsing many times over the last decade or so, and it was very difficult for that place to be surviving on the back of oil prices. And certainly, I think that that kind of also ended up feeding the political turmoil that we've had over those years. Same goes to Argentina as well. But there are parts of South America that are improving, parts of South America that are starting to see this influx of capital. And, you know, I think there are pockets of value. There, not everything is value in South America. Not everything is supposedly an arbitrage or major value attractive opportunity. But yeah, I think Brazil, Bolivia, some parts of Peru, some parts of Mexico, even, and some other regions are quite attractive. And so we are selective. It all depends on the uniqueness of the project itself and the quality of it as well. The prices are being sold, who is running the show. That is even more relevant in places like South America, their connections and capabilities of getting permits and so forth. And in some parts like Bolivia, for instance, you can get likely your permits and even mines being developed much quicker than places like North America, for instance, which is a surprise for a lot of people. We are working with different projects in Bolivia, which we think we can put into production in a much quicker manner than other projects would be done in places like Nevada or like you mentioned in Canada as well. So yeah, I think it's an attractive opportunity, but that's just my opinion.
So Tavi, let's kind of combine this topic then with a few other big themes that investors look for. So when you're looking in some of these other jurisdictions, not so much tier one jurisdictions, how important is it, one, that there are larger companies working and successfully operating in those areas? Because that ties into that whole concept of nobody actually wants to build an asset. They just want to sell it. They want to drill and sell it and get out. How important are both of those factors when you're looking at companies? One being operating companies in the jurisdiction, and two, that whole strategy of simply selling an asset, not developing it.
Well, it's such a big question because the notion I have, at least, is that everyone in this market, particularly in exploration, is a seller. And I'm referring to the CEOs of those companies. And maybe this is a function of the bear market and the depressed market we've had over the years and all the issues we've had with this industry that is causing most of those CEOs to be happy with potentially selling their assets for 2 to 3x of what they pay for, knowing that, you know, or ignoring the fact perhaps that the potential for those assets, if they are developed and taken into production one day, which I know it's a long-term plan, would likely unleash a much larger value for the investors. And so I think this is creating a setup for someone to be very creative, someone who has access for capital that is able to enter the space and able to acquire most of those high quality exploration names and take them into production. I'm not saying Crescent has necessarily the goal of being that, but we're certainly open for the idea, which I think it's almost being presented to us at this point, given the fact that what I thought it would happen a while ago, which is the supply cliff issue with most of the major companies are facing, that the M&A activity would be heating up much quicker. But we haven't seen much of that. Yes, I should point out that our core investments that we have at Crescent, meaning the companies that have recently defined that they do have a significant amount of resources and are on track to become major discoveries over time, are certainly now in engagement with the major companies, which to me, this is a new theme. We haven't really seen this in early 2022, for instance. I would say in the last 4 to 5 months, things have really heated up on that front. We even had an example of a company recently, with it, which is Snowline Gold, that got an investment from B2 Gold. And so, but this is happening across most of the, or, you know, I would say our key investments. It's interesting as well, but I'm not sure that opportunity even is larger to be selling those assets to the majors at the prices that we're seeing. It's probably a much better opportunity for someone that has access to cash flow to be, you know, really bulking up those assets and making a large major company again. That's how major companies get developed over time. But we haven't seen anybody with that type of vision being able to create those. And yes, this is at the same time bullish for metals itself, because we know that if that's not happening anytime soon, supply will also remain constrained for the longer period of time. But at the same time, it's creating an incredible opportunity. Like I said, I'm not saying Crescent will be doing that. We are starting to create vehicles that will create cash flow to allow us to make those moves. But I think this opportunity literally is being presented to us, and it's just hard to ignore. And if it's not us, I think someone is going to be doing that at some point. But it's just amazing to talk to folks and speak with CEOs of the companies that we are investors. And the sentiment when it comes to what would you like to do with this company 5 to 10 years from now, and the overwhelming answer that we get is always that they would like to sell it to a major at, you know, call it 2 to 3x the value that is currently, or maybe 5x the value it's currently. But that's not how Ross Beaty became a billionaire. That's not how most of those guys became, or the billionaires of the industry made really their money. It was through developing, not only finding those major discoveries, but really developing new major companies that on the back of those became, a large percentage of their wealth. And so to me, this is where perhaps the real opportunity is. And it starts from the macro framework, as I said earlier, because to me, metals and mining, almost more than any other part of the commodity space, is what looks extremely attractive, not only from a fundamental perspective, but also from the side of what things are likely to happen with the revitalization of manufacturing plants in the G7 economies, with the fact that we do have those inflationary forces that are likely to cause investors to look for exposure to metals. The Green Revolution is going to play a role into this. Central banks having to buy gold to improve the quality of their international reserves. I can't think of a better time to be starting to bulk up, you know, especially those high quality assets that we have in exploration part of the industry than right now, because it's everything is cheap and nobody's really willing to take that risk.
Well, Tavi, you bring up a great point there. And yeah, Ross Beaty built up his wealth by rolling things up into Pan American Silver when nobody wanted to develop these assets and put a lot of projects into one company. Keith Neumeyer did that with First Majestic. You could argue that Ross Beaty's doing it again with Equinox Gold by rolling up a lot of other projects that were stalled into one larger company with that cash flow to really acquire good quality assets and put them into production. But don't you think that if you look at the sector, a lot of the reason that most of these exploration companies don't want to hold for the long term 5 to 10 years and put it in production is they don't have those skill sets. They are geologists and explorers. They don't really have experience even in the development side and in the construction side, much less bringing a mine in production. And we have watched a series of belly flops into the swimming pool for the last few years from companies that thought they could take a small mine or a medium-sized mine and put it in production. And over again, those companies failed, never got off the mat. So there's a lot of companies watching that cycle play out and say, hey, I don't want to try to take with the team I have, or even if I bring on a new team, this project into production, I'd rather just sell it to somebody else. Isn't that why so many companies have that as their exit strategy?
Absolutely. I mean, by no means I'm saying this is an easy path. There's a reason there's one Ross Beaty out there and not 50 of those guys swimming around. And so it's not the easy path at all. I mean, the easy path is to identify perhaps you're at the early stages of a bull market for metals and mining industries and acquire a high quality exploration asset. That's the majority of the strategies across most of those CEOs. By doing that, you know, trying to get a foundation of good capital to really fund those stories at their early stages, develop those stories over time, get a hot market, sell that to the majors in an M&A cycle. Well, that's, you know, in a way, that's not also an easy strategy either to accomplish. However, I think it requires what's happening currently, which what you pointed out is just not just a capital trend of lack of investments in the commodity space, really is a labor trend, right? It's the fact that we had if you look at the enrollments for geosciences in most universities today, it's also at a secular downward trend as well, which means the interest for folks to become geologists in geosciences is just not there. And so who is going to create the next new projects and so forth? But there are some very high quality folks that you can create companies with that have the capability and ability as well to create those over time. And so I'm a believer that you certainly can create those new major companies. It's just the vision is just so far away from everyone just because we haven't seen any of that happen in the last decades. And so the risk seems far higher than what the premium should be in order to do that. And so, but all you need is a change in that tune where you start seeing one or two names and folks becoming successful in creating those new opportunities that certainly will attract more folks doing the same. I mean, we've taken an approach that is in a way similar to the venture capital approach, as I said before in other interviews, which has been to deploy large amounts of, at least for us, of capital in a very diversified way. And, you know, getting 10 to 20% stake in high quality companies with, you know, what we think are worth multiples of what they are worth currently. And then, you know, either wait for the majors to take them out or ourselves can maybe find a way to put them into production or roll them up, as you said, like Russ Beatty did. But, you know, I think there's many ways to skin the cat. And I think not necessarily I'm saying that Crescat will follow that path, but it's, you know, Newmont started that way early in the days. That's, you know, it was an investment fund that used to take stakes and interest in different great projects across the world. They had major discoveries, and over time they became what they became. And so I think that there's one potential path for us in addition to what we do in the macro side. And we're certainly looking at those opportunities and seeing if they fit of our strategy. But I think it's all becoming more and more suitable to what the macro environment really is. And it amazes me of, you know, if you look at my conviction, at least, I mean, I don't care about other people's convictions, but my conviction, at least on the macro reasons for you to be investing in the space have never been higher. I mean, my learning curve over the last 1 to 2 to 3 years has been, you know, exponentially higher. And I still think I need to learn a lot more about this industry like everybody else. But I still think that this is an incredible opportunity that everyone is ignoring. And, you know, if there is room for someone to be creative here, I think that would be ideal for us to do that.
Hey, Tavi, it would be great to see some more profitable mines built, some more companies that actually grow into some of the majors or significant mid-tiers that carry some weight, because that could actually free up some more funding for the sector. That's one of the biggest issues within this sector, is that funding has been hard to come by. Crescat has come in, and you guys have put a lot of money at work, but quite frankly, there just aren't that many new groups that have entered the sector to provide capital to exploration companies, or even to provide capital to some of the already producing companies. So that's one thing that has definitely held back this sector. We are out of time, but look, I think we can carry this over next time we chat into some of the exploration companies and flaws that you see with those strategies. So next month, we're going to have you back on. And let's more focus on some of the exploration plays and what you guys like to see in terms of what companies are doing on the drilling front. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. This wraps up this weekend show, and We'll be back with you next week. As always, please keep in touch with Shad and myself through email. Tavi, everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for taking your time with us this weekend. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.